Start the meeting, I'll calm the gavel here. And today we're just going to have Bob Hill from the Department of Human Services give us a general
overview of the financing of nursing facilities in Minnesota. And I promised Bob that if he gets done at by 2:30, then we'll adjourn the meeting. So I'm planning on going, then that'd be, what, an hour and a half. So go ahead, Bob.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Bob Hill from the Department of Human Services. And my assignment today was to talk about nursing home reimbursement. I'm going to talk about how that works today. I'm going to share some general statistics. I'm going to address the issue of whether or not there are disparities in nursing home rates across the state. I'm going to describe some of the legislation from 2007, including the rebasing legislation and some other provisions that were enacted. And when I talk about rebasing, I'm going to talk about how that affects the rate disparities. And then if there's an interest in time, I'm going to talk about some of the departments and the state's strategies for promoting quality and for rebalancing long-term care. So how are nursing homes paid? Well, the Department of Human Services sets the rates. We do it using what's enacted in statute and to some degree what's been placed into rules. The rates that the department sets are what the department pays for people that have medical assistance. That constitutes about 62% of the people that are in nursing homes at any one point in time. How does that affect private pay? Well, Minnesota has a law called rate equalization, and that means that the nursing home cannot charge a person who has private pay more than the rate that Medicaid sets. They cannot charge them more. Under the lesser of cost or charges principle, they cannot charge them less. Well, actually, I misspeak slightly when I say that. They can charge less for a non-Medicaid person, but when we know that they're doing that, then we will pay less. So we will pay them the lesser of our cost-based rate or those charges that they elect to charge to a private-paying party. So that's rate equalization in combination. There is an exception to that, which is a single bedroom. If an individual is in a private room, the facility can charge them more. And there's some rules that govern that under certain circumstances, but it gets pretty technical. So, but as you'll see a little bit later, the proportion of beds that are in single bedrooms is growing. It's up to a little over 30% now. And so that exception is a pretty significant one. In fiscal year 06, Minnesota spent $842 million from the Medicaid budget for nursing home care. Half of that was federal share, and half of it was state-county share. So from the state general fund, we spent $411.5 million in fiscal year 06 for nursing home care. Nursing homes received that money, and in addition, they received Medicaid recipient resources, about $220 million, private pay monies, about $474 million, about $209 million of Medicare and $57 million of other payer sources, for total nursing home industry revenues of approximately $1.9 billion per year. Some of the general statistics about nursing homes, number of residents. In 06, we had just over 7 million MA paid days and about 11.5 million total resident days. As of, that's about 16, 17 days ago, Minnesota had 35,708 licensed beds, and of those, 1,275 are not in the MA program, leaving 34,500 beds that are licensed as nursing home beds or boarding care beds and are in the Medicaid program, 34,000 beds. With an occupancy of 92.5% for the year ending last September, we had approximately 32,000 residents in nursing homes, or I would estimate that that's how many we have in place right now, with a total of 76,000 people served at one point or another during the course of the year. That's because there are about 44,000 discharges per year from nursing homes. The average length of stay, 298 days, just under a year, and that's been going down steadily for many years, and as has the median length of stay, which is 30 days, meaning half of people discharged from nursing homes were there 30 days or less. So how do we set the payment rate? Well, the system we have right now we call a rate-on-rate system, and it's really pretty simple. We take a look at what their rate was on September 30th. We ask the question, gee, is there an automatic inflation on the operating payment rate this year? Has it been suspended for the next few years? So the answer is no. Were there any special things that the legislature did? The answer is yeah. There was rate adjustments and a couple other things and the quality add-on. And so we apply those to the rate that's already in place. And we have the new rates for the year starting 10-1 of the next year, in this case 10-1-07. But that's a rate. In fact, we have a case mix system which results in facilities having 34 rates plus two additional rates for kind of odd circumstances. The issue here is that people who come to a nursing home for care present widely ranging levels of need. Some people need much more care than other people. If you paid the average rate, just the set middle-of-the-road rate for everybody, the concern that the state has had, and this has been in place for over 20 years, is that it would create an incentive to serve the people who least need to be in the nursing home rather than the people who most need to be there. A case mix system looks at the resources utilized by people and says for people who need more care, who require the use of more resources, we will pay a higher rate. So it uses an assessment and a system of categorizing people that results in 34 different groups. And there's a separate rate, an individual rate associated with each of those groups. There's an assessment that's federally required. It's called the Minimum Data Set, or MDS. And that's one that facilities have been required to complete since about the early 1990s. The MDS is a pretty comprehensive form, and it's used for a number of purposes. And there is a system called RUG, Resource Utilization Group, that was designed to categorize people using the MDS. In 2002, we adopted the RUG system, got rid of our old Minnesota homegrown system, and began to use this system. And we did that mainly to reduce the paperwork and complexity of having two separate assessment systems when one would do everything that needed to be done. The assessment under RUG is conducted within 2 weeks of admission, sooner if it's a Medicare resident and more often if it's a Medicare resident. But other than Medicare, it would then be updated on a quarterly basis, completely redone annually, and completely redone when there's a significant change of condition. Each one of those assessments is now used to establish a RUGS category and a rate, and that rate then would be in place for 90 days. In 2004 or thereabouts, we conducted a staff time measurement study in order to determine if the rates under RUGS were really the correct rate for Minnesota type of care for people who are private pay and Medicaid. And new rates were determined. They have not been implemented yet, but they will be phased in with the rebasing that was enacted in 2007. So that's how operating is done. And then there's another part of the rate called property. The operating part of the rate covers the staff, the supplies, utilities, all the things that it takes to operate the nursing home from day to day. The property is a capital investment. It's how facilities are made whole or reimbursed for the capital investment for the buildings, the land improvement, other sorts of capital investments that are required to operate, create a place to operate a nursing home in. And so how do we set the property rate? This rate, by the way, is roughly 10% of the total payment rate. Well, it's pretty similar. We look at what's the rate at the end of the fiscal year, the rate year. This is actually the rate year, the 930 rate for property. We ask, is there an automatic inflation? There is, in fact, in statute, an automatic inflation on the property rate. Every year it goes up by CPI-U. And that factor is applied. Then we say, well, did the legislature say to do anything other than that? There are some years where things change a little bit, like you can start to do threshold projects or some such thing. And we apply those adjustments to the historic rate, and we come up with a new rate. Then we look at, well, are there any threshold projects, any moratorium projects? And those could happen at that time, or they could happen any time through the year. A threshold project is a capital improvement project that has a cost in excess of a minimum threshold, which is about $250,000, but only goes up to about $1.25 million, the maximum threshold. If a facility wants to do a capital project that exceeds that, then they have to go through a moratorium exception process, which is a competitive process that only occurs when the legislature grants the Commissioner of Health authority to do a moratorium exception process and then appropriates money to fund those changes. There's one other segment to the payment rate in addition to operating and property, and we call that external fix. This is kind of a miscellaneous potpourri of little items that are either done the way they've always been done or that are done on a sort of a cost basis. For example, there's money in the daily rate cover costs, or let's say associated with costs of paying the surcharge, the bed tax. That's a fixed amount for every facility, about $8.86 or so. There's an amount for long-term care consultation fees. This is money that we include in their rate, and then the facility pays a monthly fee to the county, and the county does long-term care consultation pre-admission screening. There's money in the rate associated with paying their licensure fee. The surcharge, which has been in place for about 6 years now, is a cost-based element. A facility that doesn't provide eligible scholarships. Did I use the word surcharge there? I meant to say scholarship. If they don't provide any, there will be no payment to them to cover the cost of scholarships. But there's no other upper limit on this. We have some facilities that are getting a scholarship rate in excess of $1 per resident day. Strategy that helps stabilize staff, help people become trained in areas that can advance their career within the nursing home or within long-term care. There's set amounts for plan closures, for single bed incentives. There's cost-based amounts for property taxes and insurance and PERA. The surcharge, I know it's been talked about a lot, and it is a sort of...
Mr. Hill, the property tax is only paid by for-profit. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the property tax would be paid by for-profits, but some non-profit facilities make payments in lieu of taxes, and those would be allowable also. The history of the surcharge is that when it was enacted in 1993, it was $620 per bed per year. The next year it went up $5. In 2002, it went up $365, $1 a day. And when that increase was enacted, there was a rate increase associated with that of $1.25 a day. Since there's no rate collected on vacant bed days or Medicare days from other payers, the rate associated with it was greater than the actual cost of it. And then in the following year, the tax went up $5 a day to $2,815 per bed per year, and the rate associated with that went up $5.56. So that's the simple story of how rates are set. The question is, do we have disparities? Do people pretty much across the state get the same payment rate, or are there actually differences? We've got a couple ways of looking at that. This first chart shows the standard deviation. It just looks at what is the average difference of rates from the average. And what you can see is that it's currently running about 12.5%. It was as low as just under 11%, and as far back as it tracked, about 13.5%. So it has moved up and down. When it went down in 01 and 02, that was probably associated with some disparity provisions that were enacted that gave rate increases to the facilities in the state that had the lowest rates, and then it started to diverge again. What this chart shows you is the geographic groups. This is trying to get at whether or not there's a geographic relationship in these disparities, or are they pretty much the same all over the state. Geographic group 3 is the metro area, and these are the old Rule 50 groupings. They're specified in law by counties, defined as certain counties are in each group 1, 2, or 3. Group 1 is called deep rural, and deep rural is currently running about 85% on average of the average group 3 operating payment rate, and group 2 a little bit higher. So why are there disparities? Well, there's disparities because we have a rate-on-rate model, and if they're different at the beginning of, at the end of last rate year, they'll be different at the beginning of this coming rate year. The costs were different 10 years ago when everybody was on a cost basis, and limits were set on a geographic basis. There were limits in Rule 50 that said we will only pay up to a certain amount for things like case mix related costs or other operating costs. And so those limits were determined using the geographic groups, separate limits for each group. So if group 1 had lower costs, the statistical measure that determined the limits was based on those costs, and they would have a lower limit. As people moved into the alternative payment system, this rate-on-rate model that I described, those differences became essentially set in place, and there's no way that they could go away. If a facility increases their spending under the rate-on-rate method, that will have no effect on their payment rate. All that affects the payment rate is their prior rate. So in 07, the legislature enacted a proposal that's been dubbed rebasing. It's a cost-based system that moves us back to something somewhat similar to what we had 85 through the late 90s. There's the components of the rate that I described, operating, which consists of care-related and other operating. There's external fixed, which is how I described it, and there's property, which is not affected in the rebasing law. The rebasing law has a phase-in schedule. Using costs for the year ending 9/30/07, in other words, just a few weeks ago, we will determine rates under the new system, and we will determine rates under the old rate-on-rate system. And then we will do a blending of those two sets of rates. On 10/1/08, a facility will get 13% of the new one and the remaining 87% of the old system. On 10/1/09, we will move to 14% new and 86% old. It stays the same for 2010. And then in 2011, it starts to speed up. We go 31, 48, 65. Sounds like I'm doing something with football there for a moment. In 2014, 82%, and in 2015, the rate will be at 100% of the cost reported for the year ending in 2007. During that period of time, there's a hold harmless, which says that if that blending results in a lower rate for a facility, they will not get the rate reduction. Their rate will stay the same. Now, how do you reconcile that with what I said earlier about 34 different rates? Well, the way the law describes that is that we take what's called the DDF rate, one of those two extra rates. It's a rate that's kind of in the middle of the rate set. It's got a weight of 1.00. Some rates go higher from 1.00, some rates go lower. We will look at that and compare it between the two systems. If that rate is lower under the new system, then the facility will be held harmless. If that rate is higher under the new system, then they will get the entire new system set of rates. Some of them could be lower, but the DDF is the test rate.
Could you clarify, if we're shifting to a cost basis, but we've already locked in a rate that they were paying that's different, how can their cost be more than the rate we were previously paying? I mean, one nursing home someplace has got, let's say, the lower rate, and we're going to shift to a cost-based system. How can their cost be higher than the rate that we're already paying them?
Mr. Chair, this is a puzzling issue. There's been research that tells us that facilities are in fact paying more than what the Medicaid rate provides. There's a number of ways that could happen. For example, let's say let's look at the property rate. When a facility went into the alternative payment system back in, could have been 96, 97, up as recently as about 2004 or 5, they had a property rate that consisted of a return on their equity and their interest expenses. Let's say that facility has gotten that rate inflated every year, which they would have done. We increased it by CPI. But in the meantime, they paid off their debt. That's money that is available to be used as they see fit, and they may choose to move that money into operating. But is there more than that? Well, let's say that facility had debt that they had taken out when interest rates were really high. I think that was probably in the 80s or the 70s. Interest rates were 14, 16, 18%. In the mid-late 90s, interest rates were coming way down. If they went into the APS system, the alternative payment system, and refinanced that debt, they reduced their cost, but they had no effect on their rate. Their rate would have stayed the same. Are there other ways that a facility could spend more than our rate supports? They could have reserves that they're spending. About 70%, 65 to 70% of Minnesota nursing homes are not-for-profit or government-operated. They could receive subsidy from the government that operates them or donations from their sponsors or fundraising that they do. Some homes are very, very successful at this, and they raise literally hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. I'm not saying that that's a real common pattern, but it does occur. And that's money that they then have available to enhance the quality of care, the wages that they're able to pay, and so forth. Some facilities have a lot of Medicare days. The average statewide is about 9%. The Medicare rate it's a comprehensive rate that includes services that are not included in the Medicaid rate, such as prescription drugs, rehab services, and so on, other ancillaries. Those costs are probably reported in the total picture of costs, but those aren't part of the cost picture that the Medicaid program is actually paying for. So all of these are factors that I think could allow a facility to continue to operate while it has costs that exceed the Medicaid private pay rate. There are facilities that are now claiming, and I have no basis to disagree with this, that they've pretty much used up their reserves and the end is in sight. That I can't quarrel with it. I don't know if it's true or not. We've had a pattern for quite a few years now of seeing about a half a dozen facilities go out of business a year. That's 1.5% of the industry is closing its doors. So it suggests to me that if 98.5% of the facilities are staying in business from 1 year to the next, that the reimbursement picture overall must be approaching adequacy. I don't think that we get that high of a survival rate. To finish with this slide, we will then, under current law, rebase rates again on 10/1/2016 using the cost for the year ending a year earlier, 9/30/15, and then we will rebase every other year, every second year after that until, as long as this remains the law. The operating rates under this system have limits. For example, care-related costs, those are the costs for nursing and activities and social services, are limited to 120% of the median. And the median is determined separately for six groups of facilities. There's three geographic peer groups, they're called peer groups in this law, and two facility types. So for each of those combinations, there'll be a separate set of limits based on 120% of the median. The two facility types are hospital attached rule 80, and then which is about 65 or 70 facilities, and then the other 325 or so are other or just freestanding facilities. The other operating limit, and this is for costs from administration, maintenance, dietary, housekeeping, laundry, and so on, these are limited for groups based on just the geographic peer group to 105% of the median. In addition, there is a feature which I'll call gray zones, which says that if there's two facilities that are in close proximity to each other, but in different geographic peer groups, so if they have different limits, that there's a blending of the limit for the facility that has a lower limit. If it's within 20 miles of a facility that has higher limits, it will get a blending based on what portion of 20 miles apart they are. If they're 1 mile apart, they'll get 95% of that. If they're 19 miles apart, they'll get limits that are up 5% of the difference. And then in 2016, there'll be a provision after the phase-in is done. There's a provision that will allow the department to establish higher limits for specialized care facilities moving forward. In addition,
Representative Loffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Held. On this, so if you could give us a little more of the rationale of the upper payments or the operating payment rate limits, it's 120% of the median by those groupings for care and 105% for the kind of the operating maintenance kind of costs. I'm just struck, and maybe let me just kind of put the context of my question out there, and that this is an industry that's undergoing dramatic, radical change, and it feels like when we're talking about reimbursement systems that stays in over 10 years and then we're going to do something else in 2016, that we're really not responding to the dynamics of what's really happening in that industry. I was looking at your first statistics and the average length of stay is 298 days. That's a year almost. But your median is 30 days. There's probably not any other service grouping that has that kind of broad differences, and I think now I've heard we have three times as many assisted living facilities as we do nursing homes, so the case mix has changed, and in some communities the nursing home is doing a big wide range of people, and in other places they really are just taking the sickest of the sick, and I'm just kind of, when we have a limit of 120%, if you're in a community that has had that broad range from early Alzheimer's to people recovering from surgery to really high need people on ventilators maybe, and all of a sudden somebody opens up an assisted living down the road and you've lost all your easy care people, does that 120% limit adequately allow you to react to and respond to the fact that you've just got a whole different world in your business plan.
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loffler, there's a lot of issues that are touched on there. I have several ways that I'd like to approach answering that. First of all, on the care-related costs, 120% of the median brings in about 85% of facilities. We were concerned about some of the remaining facilities. Some of the ones that are spending more than 20% above the median simply need to figure out where they're off base on their spending, and are there ways that they can bring that into line. Others are doing more like what you were describing, various kinds of much more intense and specialized care. And that's why we wanted to have that provision allowing the department to negotiate higher rates with specialized care facilities. Because I think that those are facilities that the state definitely needs to maintain, to sustain. Those are important facilities. Just to touch on it briefly, the issue of ventilators is probably not a critical issue in this regard, because the department does have current authority to negotiate higher rates with facilities for residents that are on ventilators. We can based on actual costs, we can negotiate a rate three times as high as the existing rate for care-related costs, as high as the highest drugs rate for a person on ventilators. Very few of the people that are on ventilators actually have costs that go that high. But for the ventilators specifically is not an issue here, but the specialized care I think is. The other track I want to go down in responding to the question is that there may or may not be a problem with using 120%. And in fact, as you'll note on the next slide, I'll say it now and skip it then. When that phase-in is over, the state may go to having a range of limits depending on a facility's quality score. And so for a high-quality facility, the limit would be 125% of the median, and for a low-quality facility, it could be as low as 105% of the median. So there is a little bit of action that's going to be happening after the phase-in with those limits. But nonetheless, the question remains, is 105 to 125 the right range? Is 120%? The main thing I can tell you about that is that the language for rebasing, by and large, was an industry proposal. And the 120 and the 105 came out of that proposal. Those were not changed, other than what I described about the care-related factor coming into play later. I would say that it would not be unreasonable to study whether or not those are exactly the right limits, 120, 105, 105 to 125. Other than that, I don't know, and industry representatives may be able to provide more insight into how those exact numbers were selected.
Yeah, Mr. Hill, you have two nursing homes. This base rate you're talking about I'm trying to phrase this right. You still have the rugs, so that if a particular nursing home had the same base rate, they would get paid more than another nursing home if they have a higher difficulty of patient or a higher RUGS rating. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, if two facilities had the same base rate, let's call that base rate, is what their payment rate would be at a DDF, a RUGS weight of 1.00. We often use that as kind of the representative rate for a facility. And everybody fluctuates from that, based on their actual case mix. The facility does based on its average case mix. So if two facilities had the same DDF rate but different case mix, they would have very different actual payment rates.
Thank you.
The one thing
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick addition to that question of Representative Loeffler. When you're figuring out the median, are you including in the you know, obviously the median is the middle value, but are you including then in the list of values those specialized, those who have the specialized care, those facilities with specialized care?
Madam Chair, Mr.
Hill.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling.
I've been told we're...
I'll try not to do that again. The group of facilities would be all nursing homes that are in the Medicaid program with their reported costs. And if there are specialized facilities within that group, then they would be included. Now, there are four facilities that we might agree are specialized facilities that are called Rule 80. And they're in the hospital attached group. And that group will generally have higher limits because they will have higher costs in those facilities. And so that would benefit them. But there will be other facilities that may or may not be specialized. They're all in that mix together. That's why we felt it was important to have some ability to address the needs of those specialized facilities. And that may also be an issue that we need to revisit before 2016. The one thing on this slide that I forgot to mention is the efficiency incentive in the other operating costs. And the way that works is that if a facility's rates are at or above the limit, I'm sorry, if their costs are at or above the limit, then they will just get the limit. If their costs are below the limit, they will get half the difference, up to $3. So if their costs are $6 below the limit, they would get their costs plus $3. If they were less than that, they would just get their cost plus $3, not more than the $3 efficiency incentive. So the changes that happened in 2016 are contingent.
Just a minute. Representative Liebling again.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know if this is the appropriate time to ask this, but I just can't help but ask this now. And that is, you know, this whole thing that you're describing, I've been on this committee now for a little while, and I've visited with nursing homes in my area, and I've tried to learn about this system. It is so complicated. I think we'll all agree. This is unbelievably complicated stuff. My question is, how many people does it take in the agency to administer all of this? I mean, is it now that it's just in the computer and it just, you know, I mean, this is, can you give us some sense of that?
Mr. Hill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I noted earlier that we spent $421 million state share for the Medicaid payments, and the budget for my division is under $2 million, so that's about 0.5% of it. I have about 19 people that work in my division, doing everything that I'm describing today, which is rate setting and report cards and all kinds of, and a lot of, there's detail beyond what I'm going to talk about today, too. We manage out-of-state placements and Medicaid private room payments and negotiating vent rates and on and on and on. But, yeah, there's about 19 of us. What's going to happen in 2016? Well, it's contingent upon the rate being at or greater than 92% of cost. In other words, if the facilities have a Medicaid rate that covers 92% of the reported cost, then these things will happen. If that test is not met, well, then these will be sitting on the back burner until the test is met, and then these things will go into place. The first one is that we will rebase property rates based on actual costs. Since the operating payment is being rebased, do we need to leave room for that property rate to be funded to bring over money? Well, we're rebasing that cost, so let's rebase the other. The care-related limit based on quality that I described, And then we will institute some time limits on plan closure, rate adjustments, and single bed incentives. And I'm going to describe what those are a little bit later. But the notion here is that facilities are getting incentives for taking beds out of service. And under a rate-on-rate system, the idea there is that they would, if they took beds out of service, they would have fixed operating costs that they'd have no way to cover. And so there's these incentive payments to hopefully help be sufficient to help with that. So I'm wondering if rebasing does address the problem with disparities. What we did was we first looked at the first exhibit I gave you before, which says, well, what's the standard deviation? And 2007 actual rates, you're seeing the median and the average, and the standard deviation is $15.66, which is 12.2% of the average. If in 2008, instead of doing the blend, we went to 100% new system, in other words, what's the effect, what are the rates under the new system on 10108? The standard deviation divided by the average actually goes up 0.4%, just slightly. Interestingly, the rate, the average rate, is also going up about $13.5. And the median is going up 15 something. Which does suggest that reported allowable costs are greater than today's Medicaid rate. This is a box plot that shows you visually the effect on that standard deviation. I'm sorry, the effect on those rates and the range of those rates. The blue chart, or the blue exhibit on the left side of that chart shows you the 2007 rate, and the blue box at the center is everybody that's between the 25th and the 75th percentile. So you can see that when we move into the new system, the rates go up and the spread gets a little wider. We're going to see some more of these box plots. Kind of an interesting way of visualizing what's happening. What happens between the geographic groups?
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Held, I got a question before we go into the geographic groups, just to clarify things for me. If we were to rebase, in my opinion, how we should, which won't happen until 2016, if we were to rebase the actual cost, is there a need for geographic groups anymore, or are we then reimbursing nursing homes for what the true costs are? How would that work?
Mr. Hill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bosch, I that's the question I've been puzzling about. I think that the argument for geographic groups says something along the lines of, you know, costs are different parts of the state. Cost of living is probably different parts of the state. And the conclusion that one would then draw from that is that these very low rate earners, nursing assistants, housekeepers, laundry workers, dietary workers in particular, are worth a little bit less in deep rural areas than they are in metro areas. The industry has explained why they feel that the peer groups, the geographic groups, are necessary. They may have to explain it again so I can understand it. What I kind of gather is that the new peer groups, different counties in each group, as before we said geographic groups and all peer groups, three is now one is three. Other than that, I'm not sure why the impact would be any more favorable than it was last time. I think there's also sort of a funding problem, and it's one that I think puts legislators in kind of a no-win situation as long as the amount of money that you have available is relatively limited. If you got rid of the geographic groups, if you just said, we're just going to set those limits for all facilities, one group, or we're going to go along with that facility type business but not these peer groups, well, what would happen is that Metro facilities would be getting frozen for 8 years. Almost, well, in a much higher proportion than in the rural areas. In other words, you would be making a decision, the impact of which would be to redirect money, new money towards the rural areas. I think that's a political decision, and it's one that makes me happy I'm not a member of the committee. The alternative would be that you would raise, well, essentially what that would be doing is raising everybody to kind of a metro standard, which means the metro facilities don't get anything. The alternative would be that you put enough money into it so that everybody gets increased. And this is why it's still a lose-lose situation, because in that scenario, the metro facilities in general will get increases, but they won't be nearly as big as the rural facilities. So you're ending up in the same place, where all your new money is predominantly going to a rural area. So it seems to me there's a funding and political problem that I don't know how to resolve other than with really big megabucks. And otherwise, you're preserving a system that also has problems.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Held. I agree with you that there are differences among geographic groups. I mean, to buy a house 300 miles north of here is much cheaper than in the metropolitan area. However, if we were to truly rebase, wouldn't that rebasing take into account those disparities already?
Mr. Chair, what rebasing will do is address the disparity between a facility's cost and its rate. It will not, as you'll see as I move forward, it will not reduce disparities between geographic groups.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you. One last question. I think that's fine. Because I think everybody recognizes here the costs are different throughout the state. The issue I have is right now with the three different groups we have, the lines are arbitrary because of counties and not based on true costs. If we were to truly rebase, even though we have disparities after rebasing is done, but if we were to truly rebase on the cost of the facilities, would we need to have geographic groups any longer?
Mr. Hill.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hodge, I think the way that you could consider getting at that issue would be to move forward with the rebasing of the cost basis and to consider putting some money in addition to that towards disparity. And that disparity money could be, there's lots of ways to do that that could have any cost level you chose to fund. But to the degree that you do that, you take those lower rate facilities and give them more of an opportunity to perform on a sort of a level playing field with the facilities that have higher rates. To the degree that rates and quality or rates and performance affect each other. There was something you commented that I thought was a bit ironic, though, having to do with, I don't know if I should vote here or not, but please, now that I've started.
Don't worry, you won't.
Having to do with the cost of housing being different in different areas of the state. Essentially, what this sort of a system does is it, and I hope nobody's going to quote me, but it kind of takes people working in the entry-level type jobs, the nursing assistants, who may be lifelong nursing home employees, and makes them in a rural area equally as incapable of buying housing as people in a metro area.
Mr. Held, that chart you had up there just before this one.
Is this the one you wanted to see?
Yeah, that one. Those four dots at the top, are those the ones that would lose money if we rebase and didn't hold people harmless?
My guess, Mr. Chair, is that those are some specialized care facilities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Courage Center, I think, is one of them.
Could well be, yeah.
And Representative Bunch.
I'm going back to Representative Hosh's question because I'm still confused. If there's two kinds of theories. One's based that you have observed differences in the payments that are going to these different facilities based on rates that may have nothing to do with their actual costs. And then there's disparities that are a result of differences in costs. And
that the different facilities face. If in terms of what you said about housing costs, if what the goal is to make basically people who work in these facilities, either in the metro or in the outstate, have equal purchasing power, i.e. they can afford the same level of house with the salary they have in a rural area relative to what a person with higher salary can purchase in the market in the metro area. And that's, as an economist, that's how I would think what the goal would be, probably, is that they're kind of an equal playing field depending on which market they're in. Then, well, I think what Representative Hoskins was getting at, and I still didn't hear the answer really, was if rebasing is, if we're ideally rebasing, if we're trying to truly make it based on the actual cost, if we do that and we have a, you know, facility-specific formula that does that based on their actual cost, then why would we have any, you know, additional calculation that's made based on some geographical peer group that they're in, because in fact it's being based on their cost related to that facility.
Well,
Mr. Hill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, the system probably has to have some kind of limits. If it didn't have any upper limit to how much your rate could be relative to cost, then it might very well drive itself beyond what you can ultimately afford. If you're going to have limits, then the question is, how do you limit those costs? Mm-hmm. And should you have a geographic component? But this proposal was enacted because it does have that. Mm-hmm. We had looked at a way of setting limits that looked at prevailing wages. Mm-hmm. In economic development regions or in counties, and the impact of that was much more dramatic than the geographic groups of the two. There were much, much bigger differences of like 40%, and we felt that was driven in large part not by the fact that people in the metro area are just paid more, but that there's different kinds of jobs. Mm-hmm. And so if you then say, well, let's just pick relevant types of jobs, such as nurses, well, then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're paying nurses more because they're paid more. Mm-hmm. And it still didn't address the issue in a very satisfying way. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, for all I know, this could be the best conceivable way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Might not be. Mm-hmm. I think I started out saying it's a really tough question. Hopefully, don't know the answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Lovett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to testify, I mean, in education, what we are debating, I think you all know this, is a location equity index. I mean, this in absence would be a location equity index for nursing homes. And that was where, if you remember, I think it was, who had the bill, but Mindy really liked that bill, Representative Greiling. Yeah, John Benson had the bill, and it would favor and give higher costs in the education weighting formula, specifically based on location. I mean, are around the country, are there location equity indexes around nursing homes? I mean, is that done or a trend?
Sure, Representative Slavik, I don't know. Cost-based systems are the most common types of systems. I can't believe they don't have some kind of geographic adjusters, but I haven't studied those systems or asked that question.
Representative Slavik. Yeah, well, and it would be based on location. It's a cost location.
I would guess there probably are generally those types of systems in other states.
That's right, because in education, that's definitely where the trend is.
Mr. Hill, continue.
So, what is the effect of the rebasing on rates when you consider them using the old geographic groups? Well, I'll cut to the chase on the lower right. What we see is that, in fact, Group 2 as a percent of Group 3 does improve. Over a period of 8 years, it'll improve 2.4%. In just another 32 years, we could probably have that problem list. But Group 1 as a percent of Group 3 only goes up 0.8%, so that's going to take about a century to fix on that side. But before I noted that the rebasing doesn't improve it. It actually does a little bit, but it still leaves some ways to go. And this is that similar type of display showing you for the geographic groups. The two on the left are geographic group one, the two bars on the right are geographic group three. And then this is the same analysis using the peer group geographic distinction instead of the old geographic group of Rule 50. And in this one, group three, the deep rural, as a percent of group one, now remember group one is metro, gets a half a percent better, but group two compared to group one actually goes down 1.7%. And so it falls a little bit behind. And this is the visual display of that. Falls behind, that is, in the sense of disparity is getting a little bit greater. As you can see, for all three groups, the rates do go up pretty substantially in the rebasing model.
Representative Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick question. On that, the slide, the peer group slide, the percentage, aren't those last two categories, three as a percent of one and two as a percent of one, inversed?
One is,
I think you have it backwards.
One is metro. So we're showing the two lower groups as a percent of metro.
Exactly.
In this slide, three was metro.
Yep.
The old system switched one and three.
I understand that, but I'm saying the last two columns. I think the column that says 3 as a percent of 1 should actually be titled 2 as a percent of 1 when you look at the numbers.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I can't calculate and compare percentages.
Okay. Well, I'm just saying because you made the statement that that peer group 2 actually went down, but I don't think it does.
Dollar-wise, it goes down, but what this is saying is that the disparity has gone up slightly. I'd have to recalculate those. We'll recheck those numbers.
Okay.
Representative Anderson.
I've got my question answered.
Okay.
So the bottom line is, does rebasing reduce disparities? The answer is yes and no. On a statewide basis, they go up a little bit. Using the old geographic groups, I thought they both got better. Here I wrote decrease and increase. Mm-hmm. And on the new one, they go both ways. So I think overall the effect on disparities is minimal. Of rebasing. The effect of rebasing on disparities is pretty minimal. There were a couple other provisions that were enacted in 07 that were important about nursing homes. The first one was the across-the-board rate adjustment, 1.87%, plus a quality add-on averaging 0.13% up to 0.3%. The COLA, the 1.87%, is encumbered. The law requires that we give that to nursing homes only after they've submitted an application that we've approved that shows how they will spend 75% of the new money on compensation-related costs for eligible employees. Two-thirds of that money must go to provide each employee a wage increase in an equal hourly percentage effective on the same date. In addition, there was money appropriated for the moratorium exceptions, the major capital improvements. The health department now has begun that process. The RFP was issued, I believe, in August, and the application timeline has ended. There's about 16 applications that have come in, and decisions will be made about those over the next several months. In addition, $2.5 million was appropriated for improvements to life safety sprinkler, fire suppression sprinkler systems. And that process has been gone through, and the facilities that have made or will be making those improvements have submitted applications or had the opportunity to, and those rate adjustments have been provided to the facilities that submitted those. The law required us to look at the actual cost of those applications and compare that to the $2.5 million, and if the cost was greater than $2.5 million, we were required to take a discount against everybody in order to come in within the $2.5 million. That turned out to be a 20% discount. Not nearly as much as we were afraid it might have to be.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Held. Before we move on from the COLA increase, I just wanted to, this was a good learning opportunity for us in terms of when we talk about administrative complexity and how much we think we run the show and how much other things get translated into even more complexity, in that it sounds simple, the 1.87%, 75% has to go to compensation. This attached here is a big, thick package. Is the instructional bulletin that DHS sent out to everybody on how to implement this. It has the forms that they're required to do, the notices that they have to post to their employees, how it gets handled differently in an ICFMR versus a group home versus a DT&H. And I had a constituent who was concerned about whether or not the pass-through was adequately being applied, and over, and we had to put together for the past 5 years what the directives were. And I have to say, I told him that he couldn't probably make any claims against his employer based on simply reading this. He really needed to talk to someone who understood it, because we have made it very, very difficult. But I just think this is an example of how when we think we've agreed to something kind of simple, the actual implementation with the 19 staff and DHS and the people in, you know, all the facilities, it gets even more complicated.
This is just payment.
Mr. Hell, you can continue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it actually is a fairly complicated law. And when you take those principles and try to apply them to the realities of what's happening, it's unbelievable the kind of questions that come up, and this has been true over the years.
I'm agreeing with you.
How
that works.
We actually, the governor's proposal was not to have any of those encumbrances. It would have been a lot simpler. But this should have the effect of ensuring that every worker will, in fact, get a wage increase. That was the intent of it, and that's the intent that we try to live up to. The reason that bulletin is so long, it's about 90 pages long, I think. When I printed it out, I didn't want too much paper, so I put two sheets on a page. But with the attachments, it probably goes over 90 pages. It's pretty lengthy, but it's actually designed by putting each provider type separately. A provider only has to read their 5, 6, 7 pages. They don't have to read the other sections to figure out how to do those. And we felt that would probably be a simpler, even though it's a very redundant way of presenting it, would be simpler for the providers to use than other ways that we could have set that up. So, moving on, there are a number of strategies that we are pursuing to use the payment system to facilitate or encourage or incent quality improvement in nursing homes. We have a report card. We publish on the web. This is a collaboration between the Health Department and the Department of Human Services. A nursing home report card. Every nursing home in the Medicaid program can be found there, and they get rated on a number of measures. We use some of those measures to provide a quality add-on. For the rate year beginning 10-106, that was a quality add-on of up to 3%, or up to 2.4%. This year it's a quality add-on of up to 0.3%. We also have a performance incentive payment program, and the principle or policy that I described earlier that will go into place in 2016 regarding setting rebasing limits based on quality. But why are we so concerned about quality? What you have here is what's called a scatter diagram. Each of these circles represents a nursing home. And it's positioned on this graph based on its Medicaid attainment rate and its quality score. So on the upper right, what you have are facilities that have high rates and high quality, and on the lower left, you have facilities that have relatively lower rates and relatively lower quality. Well, the spread of these kind of looks like somebody sneezed on the screen, but what it is it's actually almost a perfectly random distribution. And we feel that with the facilities in the lower right, where we're paying a high rate and getting a low quality, that's really not what the system ought to allow for. And for the facilities on the upper left, where we're getting a relatively high quality for a low rate, we're thinking, well, one, it's possible, and two, do they know something the rest of us can learn from? Which is one of the reasons why we wanted to have the performance incentive payment. And overall, as a purchaser, spending over $400 million out of the general fund every year, our feeling is that role as a purchaser needs to go beyond just paying bills, just covering costs, just applying an inflation factor and paying a little bit more each year, that we ought to be thinking about, does this have some influence on quality? So the report card, which began in January 2006, has a number of purposes. The main one is to recognize that nursing homes are better at knowing information about quality than their consumers are, and to try to even that playing field a little bit, to let potential consumers compare based on objective, external, standardized quality measures that are done the same for everybody, and to let current consumers use that information to advocate for quality. And also to allow facilities to see how they compare, rather than subjectively thinking, well, we really do a great job. You can objectively know, hey, we are doing a great job, or ooh, we're not doing as good as we thought. Maybe we need to work on something here. We have seven measures of quality in the report card. Quality of life, based on face-to-face interviews in every nursing home with a sample of residents. Those are done annually. We just finished our third year. Quality indicators based on the assessment data. This is clinical process and primarily quality. How much hours of care do they provide? How well do they retain their staff? Do they use a lot of temporary staff? What portion of their beds are in single bedrooms? And how do they do on their state inspections, their state federal inspections? The report card gets visited about 1,600 to 2,000 times a month. And you can see that that's fairly
high. Let me interrupt you for a second. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to go back to your scatter chart. That's the right name for it. And I just wanted to ask you, who's included in here when you're looking at cost versus quality? Are you including the three groups all in there mixed together?
This is, Chair, Representative Liebling, this is all nursing homes together.
If that's the case, I guess I would say that it doesn't have a lot of meaning. I mean, I understand now we're going into the quality measures, and I'm not saying that looking at quality in some way isn't useful. But, you know, the conclusion that you're drawing that, you know, somehow that there's something that can be learned from the one sector that's got high quality and low cost, if you're blurring together, we just went through this whole discussion about the different groups and the different costs because of geographic areas and all that. So I'd like to see this broken out by those groups to have it have any real meaning.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an interesting issue, and we will do that.
Okay, and Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Heldon, the quality measures, I really like the idea of going to quality, but I think sort of is there sort of not necessarily, I think some of the best measures, and I'm thinking of how we look at measuring quality in healthcare, it's not by the number of nurses hours on the floor. It's about, you know, whether or not you have an infection rate or you have, you know, other things. And I'm wondering, as we go to a more disabled population and nursing homes as opposed to assisted living and other supportive systems, you know, whether that face-to-face resident quality is even accessible. I mean, I know people who are afraid to give honest assessments because they're afraid that it'll be taken out on their loved one or family member and that sort of thing. But if you had measures of what percent of patients' hearts in a chart audit showed bed sores over a month, or what percent of, you know, repositioning were noted in a, you know, a week of certain people who are totally unable to do that on themselves, you know, infection rates. I mean, some of those things might be actually really related to the care that the family isn't going to see, particularly overnight care. And the proportion of single rooms, to me, is just rewarding or punishing agencies based on their history. You know, single rooms are a new phenomena. And so if you're in an older community with an older facility, it may be very, very difficult to convert your facility to that kind of a standard. And so it feels like we're taking a physical structure characteristic and saying that quality. I would think anyone who's looking for a nursing home for their loved one would, you know, figure it out by, you know, look at whether it's single rooms, double rooms. I think we still got some of the old triple rooms around somewhere. But so I wouldn't really want a property characteristic to be a part of the quality measure, because that's just a fact. I mean, it's like, is it on a nice road you could have, or does it have adequate parking? I mean, I think that if we're going to call it quality, it actually should be about the care. So I'm wondering about that particular measure, but also have you looked at some other sorts of ratings of quality of the care rather than just measuring input?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, representative Laughlin, I think we're pretty largely actually in agreement on those issues. The issues like infection rates, falls, decubitus ulcers, those are all clinical outcomes that are part of the QIs, the quality indicator part of the report card. And that's the second item, second bullet. And so that's why I referred to that and the quality of life as really outcome measures. And as we've moved forward with this, and particularly as we translate this into the quality add-on, we've tried to increase the emphasis on outcome measures as opposed to process or input. The single bedrooms is actually not even used for the quality add-on. It's there because consumers may want it. But it's also a measure that we feel is also of relatively little interest. And eventually what we would like to do is move to a more global environmental assessment, which looks at, does the environment facilitate independence, dignity, functioning, rehabilitation, both in terms of the resident's room, the nursing unit, and the facility as a whole. And there are assessment instruments that we could use to do that, but it would be a very expensive process. And in terms of enhancements to the report card, the priority for enhancement that we're thinking we want to move toward would be a family satisfaction measure as our next enhancement, and then probably look at the environment. I think the thing about the single bedrooms is that it's really interesting to know that, and it's an important measure if you get one. But if 31% of the rooms are in singles and you've got a triple or a double, who cares how many are in singles? I totally agree with you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that, just that point, actually, well, everyone thinks they want their own room. The social interaction sometimes, if you get the right roommate, could actually be a health-enhancing thing, too. I mean, it's really interesting how the two things can actually intertwine, because if you're in a single room and nobody has time to interact with you, and your family only comes on Sunday afternoon, it can be a pretty lonely existence, too.
That was a big yes, though.
That's a big yes, I know.
The availability of singles tends to reduce issues of behavior management. I kind of mentioned this. The quality add-on was up to 2.4% a year ago, up to 0.3% this year. For October 1, 2008, current law has no quality add-on. I didn't have room for more question marks. So for the most recent quality add-on, the prior year, the quality add-on was 50% outcome measures. This year, it's 55% outcome measures. And to come back to what Representative Lawson was commenting, staffing. Many of our stakeholders feel that staffing is really important. We think you obviously have to have adequate staff to provide good care, but it's really an input, it's a process thing, it's not the outcome. Mm-hmm. And so we, in determining what the quality add-on will be, we really believe that it's important to emphasize the ability to achieve outcomes.
Mr. Hell, other than I think the reporting is important to the public, but who's going to change their behavior for 0.3%?
Mr. Chair, I think at 0.3% it has a great deal of symbolic value. It would be up to about, maybe up to about 50 cents a resident day.
Yeah. Well, my point was in a lot of the things we're doing in the medical area as well, and pay for performance, those kinds of things. I think it's public knowing what the quality is makes a much bigger difference than the financial reward to those providers.
And
certainly if we're paying somebody 0.3% more than they would have gotten, I don't think they're just going to change their behavior for that 0.3%.
I don't.
If you publish it, then it might make a difference.
There's been studies in other medical areas showing that if you measure quality, it has some impact.
Yep.
If you give that measure, if you publicly disclose that measure, it has a much, much bigger impact. The performance incentive payment program from 2006, we had $1.2 million available for the fiscal year that we're in now, and we have contracts with roughly 30 facilities that are going to get these performance incentive payments, and we'll have quite a bit more money in the next fiscal year, which is beginning that process. We ask all facilities are eligible to propose projects. They can get operating payment rate increases up to 5%, and part of that payment will then be contingent upon achieving specified goals. What we're trying to do here is recognize that the state doesn't know everything. The providers have a lot of innovativeness and creativity. They're right there in touch with the issues they have to deal with, and we want to give them an opportunity to pursue some of the ideas that they have. We then hope to take what they learn from these projects and disseminate those learnings on a statewide basis, the goals being to improve quality and efficiency and to contribute to rebalancing long-term care. So with all this stuff happening with quality, what's happening with quality? Well, this is a chart that shows for each of the quality of life domains. These are the ones that come from the resident face-to-face interviews. Now, we did 14,000 interviews each of the last 3 years, roughly 14,000 each year. And you can see the domains along the bottom. And if I showed you the chart from 2005 to 2006, it would have been a little bit discouraging. There's a little bit more showing actual declines on some of the domains than improvements. There's a little bit of improvement, a lot more decline, very small declines. This year, however, what we saw that from the third round compared to the second year was several areas that had statistically significant improvement, up to about 3%, which is kind of a lot, and a few areas that actually show declines and that were statistically significant, but the largest was only about 0.5%. So this is a change in quality over the last year that we consider to be pretty marked and important, and we're very pleased about. How about on the quality indicators? This is the only place in the handout, and I'm afraid in the handout version you won't be able to read these domains, but what you've got along the bottom are the quality indicators, and these are the types of measures that Representative Lawson was asking about, pain, incontinence without a plan, weight loss, that's unintended weight loss, infections, pressure ulcers, both new ones and cured pressure ulcers, a positive measure and a negative measure, falls, urinary tract infections, so on. From the beginning of when we were compiling and analyzing this data till March of 2007, this is the trend, and we're seeing improvements as high as about 8% on issues like pain and cured pressure sores and incontinence without a plan. But almost every one of these is showing some improvement over the last 8 years. So it says to us that there is a trend of what's going on in Minnesota nursing homes, and it's a positive trend.
Representative Flowers.
Mr. Chair, just out of curiosity, has 14,000 surveys or interviews?
Interviews.
How are those? Is this done on intake or as part of the process?
What happens is that we have interviewers through a contractual arrangement that visit every nursing home. They start in about February, they're done in May or June. And they visit every nursing home, and they visit a random sample of residents. The sample excludes the most severely cognitively impaired residents. But other than that, everybody's eligible to be part of that sample. It's weighted for short stay, so that we get a comparable portion of the short stay versus long stay. It's a big project that we do once a year.
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
How are we doing on staffing? Well, this one I found rather surprising. I remember speculating with some of our stakeholders earlier in the year that with the freeze in rates and the small COLAs that facilities are probably cutting back on staff. This says to us not so. The standard nursing homes, that's most of them, actually increased staffing levels by about a quarter of an hour per resident day between 04 and 05. And the hospital attached by about a half an hour. These are wage and acuity adjustments, which this means you can't say that you're going to go in there and actually find 4.3 hours of direct care staff per resident day. The acuity adjustment means that case mix weight is taken into account, and the wage adjustment means that higher paid staff like RNs are counted as more than lower paid staff like nursing assistants. And the reason for that was to avoid creating an incentive to get rid of all the nurses and hire all nursing assistants. We wanted this to be reporting something that more truly reflected what overall was happening without creating an adverse incentive. How about staff retention? Well, it looks like nursing homes are of direct care staff are actually retaining about 70% of their employees from the beginning of the reporting year to the end of the reporting year. And this is pretty consistent all the way from 02 up to 05. We'll have 06 in here pretty soon.
Is that a change? Because it seemed to me back, maybe it was back when the economy was booming there, some homes were having only retention rates of around 40%.
Well, some Mr. Chair, some homes, this is the average, statewide average, so it varies quite a bit. Some homes do have very low retention rates. I suspect it was lower before we were collecting the data, but how would you know? The use of temporary nursing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one real quick question, Mr. Hill. The staff retention, does that also include hospital attached nursing homes?
This is Mr. Chair, Representative Hawks, this is all nursing homes. So the CNSDs are included.
And just one quick follow-up. It'd be interesting, and if you were able to compile the information to see what the disparities are among hospital-attached nursing homes and non-attached nursing homes, and also geographic groupings too. Is there a difference with retention levels?
It'd be interesting. Yeah. We haven't done that quite yet.
When you start
getting data, there's no end to effective analysis. Those are really interesting suggestions. We will do that.
Thank you.
Continue.
SNSA, Supplemental Nursing Service Agency, you've heard of as temp staff. On the bottom of this chart, what you see is nursing facilities that are not using any supplemental staff. And that number went from 59% of nursing homes in 03 up to 68% in 05. In other words, a larger and larger proportion, more and more nursing homes, are not using any temporary staff. The bar chart on the top shows you what portion of their staff comes from nursing pools of those that are using nursing pools. So not only are fewer nursing homes using them, but the amount of nursing pool usage of those using it has gone down as well. So that's the data I've got on quality measures. And then I've got just a little bit of information about another major policy initiative of the department, and that has to do with rebalancing long-term care, encouraging the availability of more home and community-based services that people would prefer to be able to stay in their home rather than being in a nursing home to the degree that that's possible. How do we do that in the context of a nursing home? Well, the main strategy is to close unneeded beds. And that's been encouraged through going back actually to the early 1980s, the establishment of a moratorium. No new beds can be added in Minnesota. There can be replacement beds, but you can't add a new bed without an act of legislation. Pre-admission screening. Do people really need to be there before they can go in? Funding of home and community-based services. Much more recently, enhancing rates, 20% higher by Medicaid and private pay for the first 30 days of the stay in a nursing home. Even the surcharge is actually an incentive, because if you have low occupancy, you're paying a big tax on empty beds. It encourages you to take those beds out of service. And what we found is that when there's fewer empty beds, caseload goes down. Medicaid caseload goes down. So closing an empty bed actually results in savings to the Medicaid program. In more recent years, the legislature has enacted a layaway program, allows facilities to put beds in the bank, see how it works out, get some financial benefits from doing so. We currently have 1,233 beds in layaway. They can put those back into active service up until 5 years after it was put in layaway, then it's just gone. In 2001, we began the planned closure program. It expired in 2003 and was reenacted or reinvigorated in 2004. We've been closing an average of almost 1,000 beds a year over the last 8 years. Not all those 8 years have we had this program. The single bed incentive was enacted in 2005. Thought that would have a much bigger impact than it in fact has had. Anytime there's a closure of a bed that results in a single bed being created, a single bedroom, the facility is eligible to get a rate increase for that. This next chart shows you the number of beds per year that have been taken out of service. It fluctuates a lot, but as you can see, it's been averaging about 900 beds a year. And just a visual that shows you the trend in the number. It looks like we're going off the bottom, but the bottom of the scale is 37,000. And then the moratorium law requires us to give you a recommendation every other year as to whether or not we still need to have the moratorium. The report called The Status of Long-Term Care in Minnesota was released a year ago now, and it includes this analysis, which says, well, we've got this trend of closing beds, and we've also got a trend of declining utilization, which I'll show you in a moment right now. This is a bit of a complicated chart, but what it shows you on the left is for people 65 and older, and on the right, 85 and older, what the utilization rate has been. In other words, at the upper left, 1984, 8.4% of people age 65 and over were in a nursing home at any point in time. For the 85 and older, that was 36.4%. By 2005, the 65 and older group declined under 5%. Substantial reduction. Less than 5% when it was 8.5%. And for the people 85 and older, it went down from 36.5% to 17.5%. Less than half the utilization rate. So that has a huge effect on how many nursing home beds we really need to have in the state. So how many beds do we think we'll need? Well, looking at population trends for those age groups, and looking at those utilization trends, we come up with quite a range of how many beds we will need. For the 65-plus group, between now and 2025, the number of beds we need is going to kind of stabilize, and it's going to be stabilizing at about pretty close to where we're at right now. But that's not really where the nursing home user group is. The people that are using nursing homes are much closer to 80 years of age on average. So perhaps the 85-plus group is a better proxy for how many beds will be needed. And that's a set of projections that declines continuously. But even using the average, what happens when you juxtapose the beds available and the beds needed? It gets hard to read. That's what happens. But the lines do cross. The average line is going to cross in 2015. In the worst case, with the 65-plus line, they're going to cross in about 2 years. In other words, what this astute analysis tells you is that we're going to run into a bed access problem for nursing homes somewhere between 2009 and never. And we tend towards the not nearly as soon as 2009 what we think will actually be the case. So we did not recommend a removal of the moratorium.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Phil. First, a point of clarification. When you say 65 plus, do you mean 65 to 83?
Mr. Representative, that's all people 65 and older. It includes the 85 plus.
Okay. Now I'm confused then. So we have, in the 85 and older, we have increasing number of people in that category, and yet we're going to need fewer and fewer beds, according to this analysis. I mean, for that group. And that's because even though we have a large number of people, they're no longer using nursing home care as much as they did in the past.
Between now and 2025, at least.
Okay.
The trend is that the growth in population will be offset by the declining utilization rate.
Yeah.
Now, that utilization rate decline could stop in its tracks. It could be that it has bottomed out. It could reverse.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we looked at it here by saying, well, what's the trend been for the last 5 years and the last 10 years?
Mm-hmm.
And there those two lines are very, very close together.
Mm-hmm.
So we're inclined to believe that that's a trend that's been going on since 1984. It's mm-hmm. probably going to continue.
I mean, if we had assisted, back to a point that Representative Laughlin made earlier, if we had assisted living data in this diagram, are we seeing that rise if we're seeing nursing home bed utilization go down? It's because we don't have these new other forms in this picture?
I don't have other forms of service
mm-hmm.
in them. And assisted living is a pretty important
mm-hmm.
issue in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Back in 1984, if there was any assisted living, there was very, very little.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it had been really conceptualized at
mm-hmm.
that point.
Mm-hmm.
It probably began late 80s, early 90s, with very little. There's now more units, more capacity for people in assisted living in Minnesota than nursing home beds.
Representative Bunn.
I'm new to this year, so maybe you can answer this chair rather than our guest, but is payment for assisted living so different than it is for nursing homes, such that we're never talking about these two things in the same conversation? Or are they, because to me they're just alternative forms of plus in-home care of providing for our elderly. So why do we have such a, why do we separate this, what is it about the financing mechanism that we're separating these conversations?
Mr. Hell, do you want to try and answer that?
Well, had nursing homes and been buying nursing home services probably for a century.
Mm-hmm.
When the Medicaid program began in about 1965 or 6, the industry just really grew rapidly for mm-hmm. quite a number of years. It's what we pay for. The Medicaid program, here's another one I hope I don't get quoted on, but when it was initially conceptualized, it covered nursing home care. That became the standard. It did not cover home and community-based
mm-hmm.
services.
Mm-hmm.
One has to wonder why not. Why did we have to build institutions that people did not want to go into?
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe it was cheaper for the Medicaid program,
mm-hmm.
and or at least thought to be. And what we've learned now is, one, people would really prefer home care if it's feasible. And two, if you provide home care and pay for it, you will increase the size of the caseload, but the average cost will be lower.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, that may change as more and more high acuity people mm-hmm. are increasingly in non-institutional services. But there's not a whole lot of people in assisted living that we pay for.
Mm-hmm.
It's regulated, but not very much.
Mm-hmm.
When we're outside of the nursing home, we don't pay for the cost of housing
mm-hmm.
through the Medicaid program. So it creates an institutional bias.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We had that gentleman, I think he was in assisted living, but he got the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
Who's that?
Economist from the University of Minnesota. Yeah. 90 years old.
He thought it was a joke when he got the call.
Yeah.
Representative Liebling, we got about 10 minutes to pass where he needs to.
Okay, this is really quick. What about talking about the need for beds, what about people who are younger but who are disabled? Where do they fit in this?
Mr. Hill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, the younger disabled population that requires long-term care support services is much more predominantly served outside of the institution. Mm-hmm. About 6 or 7% of nursing home population is that group. For some reason that I can only speculate on, the state has been more aggressive for a long time about non-institutional alternatives for the non-senior population than for the senior population. I think it's an age bias.
Okay, any Representative Loeffler?
Just a curious point on your needs charts and demographics. Have you broken those down by regions at all? I know some years ago we required counties to do a gaps analysis of their senior population, but I don't know that they've had to do that recently. And do we have any lower breakdowns of that?
Representative Loeffler, we have not done that. We have the data that we could do that on on a small basis as by county, but we haven't actually done that.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an area that we really do need to look at. I know in much of the metro area there's a great overbuilding of assisted living. It's kind of a new trendy thing for a lot of communities to think they need to develop. And I don't know that the build it and they will come has always worked in some facilities. And I think we really do need to look at sort of the long-range plan with the boomers aging. I see a lot of them potentially using up their assets in all kinds of different ways, including premature use of assisted living, and then having more dependency on that medical assistance splitting of the cost that we saw at the beginning of the slideshow. So I think there's some long-term implications for the state that we really ought to look at.
Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to maybe address this to you while Mr. Held is still here, though. I'd really be interested in hearing a discussion about rate equalization. That's something that we, kind of relates to this discussion, whether I know most other states don't do it the way we do it, the equalizing the rates between private and public pay. And that's something that I'd really like us to at least learn about at some point, if that would be doable.
Well, we supposedly have equal rates, but then we have that surcharge which hits the private pay people, so in effect they're paying a little bit more. Any other questions? Would you follow up on that? We'll have the committee administrators try to line up a hearing on equalization. And Representative Erickson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Held, of our overall $34 billion budget, then what percentage is spent on long-term care for the biennium?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I can tell you the nursing home amount is the $421 million. For the biennium, you could double that. And the percentage, that sounds like it's about 2 to 3%.
But that does not include the other long-term care facilities.
All the other long-term care facilities and all the home and community-based services would be in addition. I don't know. I believe that, didn't Jane Hardwick have a hearing just a week or two ago? Testify on that?
We did have it.
Okay. I wasn't at that hearing, but...
We'll get that number for you, Representative. And thank you, Mr. Held, for your presentation today. I think it was very educational, and hopefully next year when we look at the budget, we'll understand it a little bit better. So thank you, and
thank you,
the meeting is adjourned.